We are in the middle of discussing the sixth Mishnah, which is Yoshua ben Prachya Omer, Aseh Lecha Rav, Kneh Lecha Chaver, make for yourself a Rav and acquire a friend. They have a Donis Kol Adam Lekat Zchus, and judge everybody favorably. So first of all, the Shir is being dedicated by Ernie Singer in memory of his father, Gerard Singer's 23rd Yortzeit. Avram ben Mordechai. So we'll dedicate the Shir with Ilui Nishmas Avram ben Mordechai. Okay. We were in the middle last time of discussing the Abarbanel's commentary to this Mishnah. We haven't yet finished it. And we were speaking about the various benefits of having a Rav, of having someone to guide you both halachically and also advice-wise, not necessarily halacha. We're in the middle of discussing the importance of asking advice, and we said that Chazal say it's important to ask advice even from someone lesser than you. And we asked, what are you going to gain by somebody who knows less than you to ask advice? And we explained basically that advice is not only to get information that you don't have. But even if you have all the information, it's still an idea to be advised and to ask advice from someone else for various reasons. One reason is that people are biased and subjective. And when you are presented with an issue that you have to make a decision, you think that you are deliberating properly and seeing all the positive sides of all the sides of the issue and all the negative sides and weighing out the positive against the negative and coming to a decision. But in fact, the way a person works is that he sees the positive of what he deep down wants to be the solution to this issue and all the negatives of the things that deep down he doesn't want to be the solution. And even though the person thinks he's being objective and deliberating objectively, he's not really. He doesn't see all the sides. He sees more what he would want to see, how he likes to see it. And therefore, asking advice, you're asking from someone objective who is going to give you the a more objective, realistic picture of the pros and cons of the issue that you are deliberating and give you a chance to make a more intelligent and objective decision, because he weeds out your subjectivity. In addition, even if you know what the solution has to be, you don't really have a choice. But there's an idea of asking advice because how you approach something, with what emotions, with what attitude, also can change something from a mitzvah to an aveira or vice versa. And I think I gave you the example of the Bal Koreh. Anybody remember? Yeah. Right. Somebody can intend to correct the Bal Koreh because he wants to fulfill the mitzvah of Kriyas HaTorah, and he has a mitzvah. And he can intend to correct the Bal Koreh in order to insult him and embarrass him, and then he has an aveira. Two people do the exact same thing at the exact same time, but the intention and attitude changes it from a mitzvah to an aveira. So the attitude also makes a difference. It also gives a person clarity in what he's doing. And the more clear something is to you, the more you can do it with resolve and with simcha. Because if something is not clear, you do it because you're not 100% sure, then it's missing some of the clarity, and because of that it's missing the simcha in what you're doing. So I don't know if we mentioned this last time or not, but just to sum up this idea and then to go on to the next idea in this concept of asking advice, the organs of the body correspond to the various components of the neshama. In other words, there are spiritual organs and physical organs, and they correspond to each other. The spiritual organs, which are responsible for Eitzah, for advice, are the kidneys, spiritual kidneys. I think we did mention this, because I remember saying that if you only have one kidney, you shouldn't be afraid. It's only it's correlation. It doesn't come from the actual kidney. But there's a tremendous parallel between the function of the physical kidneys and advice. The physical kidneys take the poisons out of the liquids in the body, eject them, and leave the pure liquid, the pure water, to sustain the body. When it comes to advice, the Pasuk says in Mishlei, Mayim Amukim Eitzah B'Lev Ish. Advice, what a person should do, what his decision should be, are like deep waters in a person's heart. The Ish Chacham Yidlena, and a wise person can reach them and dish them out and scoop them up. A wise person can draw from these deep waters, meaning everybody deep down has the right ideas. He can really come to the right solutions and right choices. The problem is that it's very deep water, and also the water is sometimes contaminated with all kinds of desires and all kinds of subjectivity and bias. So the purpose of an Eitzah is to filter out the poisons, the subjectivity, the bias, and leave the pure waters of Eitzah, of advice, that the person then can draw upon them and make use of them properly. Before we go on, we were basing this on a medrash of Avraham Avinu, that when he was given the mitzvah of Bris Milah, he went to ask advice from his three friends, Onner, Eshkol, and Mamre, and Onner and Eshkol advised him not to do it, seemingly, and Mamre told him to do it, and Mamre was rewarded that God appeared in his portion. And we asked, Avraham Avinu needed to ask advice from three goyim if he should do the Bris Milah or not. What was the purpose of the advice? And if he's asking advice already, why didn't he ask Eliezer, his faithful student, or the Rashi Yeshiva, Shemin Aver? Why did he go to ask three goyim? And two of them told him not to do it. Only one said yes. So if you're asking advice already, listen to the advice. And if you don't plan to listen to the advice anyway, then what'd you ask for? There's one more part to this puzzle, and then we get back to that medrash. And that is the following. Just as much as a person has to want to free himself of his bias, his subjectivity, in order to be able to make the right choices and come to the right conclusions, and for that it's important to ask advice from someone else who is not biased and not subjective, it is equally important to ask advice from someone who can give proper advice, meaning not just that he knows. If you're asking a Rav, you're asking for information you don't know, the Paskin is Shaila for you, so obviously you have to ask from somebody qualified. But we're talking over here, even the advice of a friend, not just the advice of somebody greater than you, even somebody lesser than you. But there it's to get a more realistic picture of what the issue is. Here it's important that the person giving the advice knows how to give advice, meaning the following. Somebody comes to me and they ask my advice, what do I think they should do in such a situation? And I say, what would I do in that situation? I am totally disqualified from giving advice, and my advice is meaningless. Why? For a few reasons. One reason is that if I'm thinking about what I would do in that situation, then I have my bias. I have my subjectivity. So I'm just transferring their subjectivity to my subjectivity. It's what they gain. In addition, maybe what they should do in their circumstances is not what I would do in my circumstances. maybe what I would do is something different, should be something different, and what they would do has to be different because their circumstances are different. No two issues have the same solution for two different people. Someone once told me they went with a friend to ask a shaila from a gadol about what they should do. They both had the same exact issue before them, and they had two alternatives, and they wanted to know what to do, and they went in separately. So the first one went in, and the gadol told him X. He came out, and he told the other person that this is what the gadol said, so this is probably what you're going to be told. The other one went in, the same exact question, and he came out with Y. They compared notes. The gadol told each one the opposite of what he told the other one. The reason is because they're different people. This one, this was good, and for the other one, something else was good. Somebody who gives the same advice to everybody is not a person who can give advice, because the advice changes according to the situation and the circumstances of the person who's asking the advice. What's good for one person is not necessarily good for a second person. And therefore, if I say, what would I do if I had this issue, then I am basically not giving you advice. So what do I have to say? I have to say the following. If I was you, with all of your unique circumstances, but I don't have the bias that you have, because I'm not really you, but I can put myself in your shoes, with your circumstances, but not necessarily your subjectivity, how would I look at this problem? Then I'm qualified to give advice, if I can do that. I can put myself in the other person's shoes, in their, with their circumstances, with their background, with what they're capable of doing or not capable of doing, and so on. So I can only give a person advice if I can put myself in their place, except divest myself of my bias and subjectivity. That explains the following medrash. The medrash says that Nadav and Avihu, they were the ones who brought the strange fire that they weren't commanded to the wrong place, and they made incense the wrong time in the wrong place, and because of that they were killed. And each of them obviously came to the decision to bring this incense. They brought it together. So the Medrash says various sins that they committed that contributed towards their death. Amongst them, they went in, they didn't have the proper haircut, they were drunk, they didn't have the proper clothing on, and they didn't ask advice from Moshe Rabbeinu before they came to their decision. They didn't ask advice from Aaron HaKohen, their father. And then the Medrash says another aspect, they didn't ask each other advice. On the surface, it seems ridiculous. Because if each one independently decided to do this, what would have helped had they asked each other? If Nadav said to Avihu, I got this great idea about bringing incense into the Holy of Holies, what would Avihu would have said? Hey, I had the same idea. So what would have helped? But according to what we said, these were great people. If Nadav had come to Avihu and said, I have this great idea, what do you think I should do? Avihu would have put himself in Nadav's place, divested himself of his own subjectivity, and he would have seen clearly it's the wrong thing to do. And the opposite would have been if Nadav asked Avihu or Avihu asked Nadav. Because they only deliberated according to their own subjectivity, they came to the conclusion that they did. Had they asked advice from each other, they would have been able to divest themselves of their subjectivity and put themselves in the other one's place. They would have seen clearly it's wrong. And that's a clear idea. Because many times we do things and we, for ourselves, think that it's the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. And we see somebody else do the exact same thing, we realize that we're wrong. But we don't put it to ourselves. When you see it on somebody else, right, you see what they're doing is wrong. But when you do it for yourself, you don't see that it's wrong. So if you can divest yourself of your bias and put yourself in someone else's place, you'll come to a different decision many times, a different conclusion that you would when you're thinking about yourself. Putting that all together, let's go back to Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu has a mitzvah to do, bris milah. And he wants to do it as perfectly as possible. There's no question that he's going to do it. The question is, what's his attitude going to be? What does God really want from him? Avraham Avinu perhaps has his biased understanding of what God wants from him. But he needs someone who can put himself in his place and see his mitzvah in an unbiased, unsubjective way, an objective way, and give him an understanding of how he sees it in without the bias, without the subjectivity. So who does Avraham Avinu go to? He's not looking for information. He's not looking for a psak halacha. He's looking for someone who can relate to his mitzvah of bris and put himself in Avram's shoes and let him see it through somebody objective's eyes. So he goes to friends. Well, I said, I don't remember if I mentioned already, a chaver, ches beis reish, has the same osios as rav with an extra ches. The ches always represents something supernatural. Sometimes a friend can help you out more than your rav can help you out, because they know you better and they can put themselves in your situation better. So their advice sometimes is extra, beyond nature, above nature, whereas the advice of a rav is natural. This has the extra ches, the extra supernatural aspect to it. So he went to ask friends, not just any friends, friends who could identify with a bris, with a covenant. How do I know they can identify with a covenant? Because that's who they were. Baalei bris Avraham. They made a covenant with Avraham. So they already had an understanding what a covenant was between them and Avraham Avinu. So Avraham Avinu went to them and he said, God now wants to make a covenant with me. That's what a bris is. It's not just an operation. It's a sign of a connection, an attachment to God. It's a covenant. A covenant means that two people make an agreement where each one is responsible to the other and benefits from the other. That's a bris. That's a covenant. It explains why Avraham Avinu didn't fulfill this mitzvah before it was given to him. Avraham Avinu kept the whole Torah before it was given. So why didn't he make bris milah earlier? Why did he wait till he was 100 to make bris milah? I told he was 99 to make bris milah, right? Why didn't he do it earlier if he did the whole Torah? So various answers. One is, it's greater to do a mitzvah when you're commanded to do it than when you do it voluntarily. And since bris milah can only do once, he waited till he knew, and he knew that eventually God would command him this mitzvah, he waited. The other ones he wasn't going to be commanded, so he did them voluntarily. Or you could do them more than once also. There are other reasons why he didn't do it before. Some say that he didn't keep the whole Torah until he had a bris milah. So the question doesn't start. But in my estimation, there is a different idea. The Sfarno says that immediately after the bris, we find that God appears to Avraham. And doesn't say that he said anything to him. And all of a sudden, during that revelation, three angels come and Avraham gets busy with them. And God doesn't seem to have said anything to Avraham. He just appeared to him. So Rashi says he came to visit the sick, to teach us that Avraham was sick after the bris, and he came to Bikur Cholim. But the Sfarno says something else. The Sfarno says, since a bris is a covenant means an agreement between two sides, both sides have to be there. So God had to come and represent his side. Otherwise, if there's no two sides, there's no agreement. And he says that's why we put an empty chair by a bris, to represent God's presence at the bris, to be that his side is represented. Now we have an empty chair by the bris. We call it Kisei Shel Eliyahu, that Eliyahu Novi comes to every bris, and there's really no contradiction. But originally, that chair was for the Shechina. Right? An empty chair represents the fact that there's a spiritual entity that needs some place to take hold in this world. So you need a receptacle. A chair is a receptacle. A kos, a cup, is a receptacle. So on Pesach night, we have Koshel Eliyahu. At the Bris, we have Kisei Shel Eliyahu. There's always, the Gemara says that before Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi died, he said, bring a chair and prepare a place for Chizkiyahu HaMelech, who's coming to greet me. He's his ancestor. Right? He came from Malchus Beis David, and Chizkiyahu was a tzaddik. And he said, Chizkiyahu is coming, his neshama is coming, prepare a chair, because when a neshama comes into this world, as a neshama, it needs some base to attach to. So you need a chair, a coast, something that's a receptacle. In any case, the Medrash says, though, that when Eliyahu HaNavi became exasperated with the Jewish people, couldn't take them anymore, after he proved that God is true and the Baal is false on Har HaKarmel, and everybody proclaimed Hashem Hu Elohim, like we say on Yom Kippur, right? And they killed the 450 prophets of the Baal because they saw that Eliyahu was able to bring fire from the heavens to consume his sacrifice, whereas the prophets of the Baal could not do that. So they all became believers. Eliyahu went home that day, and he finds a messenger waiting from him from Izebel, the wicked queen Izebel. And she said, she sent the messenger, tomorrow I'm going to kill you. Eliyahu goes berserk. He runs out into the desert. 40 days he goes without eating. Comes to Har Sinai. The Rebbe Shem says to him, what are you doing here? He says, I am zealous for your honor. The Jewish people are no good. They've forsaken your bris, and they serve idolatry. They've relinquished the covenant, and I can't take it anymore. And the Rebbe Shem then shows him a whole show of thunder and lightning and earthquakes, and he shows him that's not where God is. God's in a still, small voice. Go back, speak to them. Don't give up on them. It's not with the fire and brimstone and earthquakes. You want to get to Klal Yisrael, they're basically good people. Deep down, right, they have a spark. Speak to them properly, you'll fan that spark. And then he gives them time to think. And after a few hours, he says to him again, what are you doing here, Eliyahu? Right, you have all these great feelings of zealousness. Go to the people and speak to them. Don't come over here and complain to me. So Eliyahu says the same thing. I can't take it. I'm zealous for your honor. These people are no good. They've forsaken your bris. The Rebbe Shem says, you can't be the prophet anymore. You want to come up here? You can be zealous up here, not down there. And eventually takes him away. But the Medrash says, he tells him, you're going to have to go to every bris, every 8-day-old Jewish child, and testify that they haven't forsaken the bris. So Eliyahu HaNavi comes as a malach, malach habris. As a malach, he can go to more than one bris at a time. A malach can divide up into many, many sparks and be in many places at the same time. So as a malach, Eliyahu HaNavi comes to every bris to testify that he's God's agent, to testify that it's not true. The Jewish people haven't forsaken the bris. They still have a bris innately from 8 days old. Innately they have a bris with God. They may turn their back, but it's always there. It can fan the fires. In any case, so therefore God appointed Eliyahu to be his agent, his representative at every bris. But you have to have a representative of God's side. So we have a chair for Eliyahu. Because, like we said, when a spiritual entity comes into a physical place, it needs a base to attach to. A chair is that kind of base. That's Kisei Shel Eliyahu. Therefore, since both sides have to be represented, otherwise there's no bris. A bris means a two-sided agreement. You can't have a one-sided agreement. Therefore, it was impossible for Avraham Avinu to fulfill the mitzvah of Bris Milah till it was given to him. Because Bris Milah is not just an action, it's a covenant. You can't have a covenant until both sides are involved. So until God commanded him that the bris is an agreement and a covenant, there was no mitzvah. You couldn't fulfill a one-sided thing. Other mitzvahs you can do one-sided. You can wave an estrog and lulav, and you can blow a shofar or whatever. But where the mitzvah is the agreement, you can't have an agreement unless the other side is part of this. You can't do it voluntarily. Agreement means two sides. So, if that's the case, the Rabbanu Shalom is making an agreement with Avraham Avinu, a pact. Who can relate to that? The people who made a pact with Avraham Avinu, who also came to an agreement with him, a two-sided agreement. They're Balei Bris Avraham. They made an agreement that each one would protect the other one and come to the aid of the other one, and they were Balei Bris Avraham. So Avraham figured, these people can relate to a bris. They can put themselves in my shoes and let me see in an unbiased way what the issue of this bris is. So he went to Onir, and Onir said to him, look, you're a 99-year-old man. This is a life-threatening operation. You're probably going to die. That doesn't say he didn't tell him not to do it. He said, but basically what he's telling him is, I assume that God wants you to sacrifice your life. Just like later on, God told him to sacrifice his son, now he's telling him to sacrifice his life. God wants you to kill yourself. Commit suicide, right, in service of him. Make yourself a sacrifice. No. Avraham left him. And he went to Eshkol. Eshkol said, look, let's even assume you survived the operation. But you just vanquished four kings whose relatives want revenge. If you're going to put your whole household in a vulnerable position, they're going to come and kill you all. Because they're going to find that you're vulnerable. You're all recuperating from this bris. Just like later on, Shechem, what's it called, was killed. The whole city of Shechem, after they were recuperating from the bris that Shimon and Levi imposed upon them. So even if you survive the operation, you're probably going to be killed by these, right? Therefore, maybe don't not do it, but again, I guess God wants you not just to sacrifice your life, to put yourself in danger and show that you're willing to abandon yourself to whatever may happen for the sake of God. Could be. Avraham left him. Came to Mamre, and Mamre said the following. Look, if God saved you from the fiery furnace, and he saved you from these four kings and let you vanquish them, then God has a good track record with you. And you can rely on the fact that you're probably not going to die from this operation, and you're probably not going to be vulnerable. So I would say, do it, and understand that God's not interested in your sacrificing your life or putting yourself into a vulnerable position. He wants to make a pact with you. It's a different idea completely. The bris is not suicide for the name of God. It's a different thing altogether. Therefore, Avraham said like this, Eshkol and Onir didn't give him bad advice. Therefore, they weren't punished for giving bad advice. They just didn't give him any advice. They couldn't put themselves in Avram's shoes. They said, if we had this mitzvah, how would we look at it? So if we had it, we would see it as suicide. We're regular people, a 99-year-old person making this operation, probably going to die. We didn't, what's it called, we weren't protected from four kings. Their relatives are going to probably kill us. So they looked at it from their perspective, and therefore the advice was meaningless. Avraham Avinu discounted it. They're not telling me what they would do if they were me. They're telling me what I should do if I were them. So there's no advice. Only Mamre could put himself in Avraham Avinu's shoes and say, if I was Avraham Avinu and God saved me from the Kibshon HaEsh and he saved me from the four kings, I live a charmed life. So then obviously God doesn't want me to commit suicide. It's a different idea completely. And he was the only one who could give advice. That's why Avraham Avinu listened to him. The other ones were not advice, because they didn't say what Avraham, how Avraham should look at it, but how they would look at it. And that's meaningless. And therefore, what was the reward of Mamre? The reward of Mamre was that God appeared in his place. Because if you want to see God, you have to be objective. You have to be able to divest yourself of your bias. Because people don't want to believe in God. They want to be free. They want to do what they want. So people close their eyes and their minds from seeing the Ribbono Shel Olam. If you're objective, you're willing to see things unbiased, you'll see God. He's everywhere. It's only if you close your eyes to him that you won't see him. And what closes your eyes is your bias and subjectivity and Yetzer Hara and desires. So Mamre, who was able to divest himself of his bias and subjectivity in order to give advice to Avraham, got the merit of God appearing in his place. Mita keneged mita. Exactly the same idea. Okay, so that is another aspect of Asei Lecha Rav, because you need a Rav for not just information that you don't have, psak halacha, to tell you what to do when you don't know what to do, you don't know what the halacha is, but you need a Rav to give you Eitzah, to give you Hadracha, and therefore Kenei Lecha Chaver. Sometimes you don't need a Rav to give you advice. You need a good friend who knows you well, who can give you advice. Okay. The reason it says, the Abarbanel says, Kenei Lecha Rav, Asei Lecha Rav, Ukenei Lecha Chaver. Right? You make for yourself a Rav and you acquire a friend. The friend you acquire by you doing for him what he needs, and then you'll acquire a friend that he'll reciprocate. A Rav doesn't work like that. The Rav, you make the Rav, and it's a one-sided deal. But the Chaver you have to acquire. You do your part, he'll do his part, and then you become friends. The Abarbanel also says that the benefit of a Rav, of a Chaver, a Rav can guide you, can give you advice. A Chaver, sometimes you come to the solution of a problem, of an issue, by discussing it with somebody else. It's the whole idea of a chavrusa. In Gemara learning, people don't learn on their own. You learn on your own, you only see your own subjective way of seeing something. And like we said, you see what you want to see, and you don't see the whole picture, and you come out sometimes with a very distorted view of what you're learning. But when you have to argue it out with somebody else back and forth, so then the truth comes out from between the two of you. By arguing something out, and each one seeing the other one's perspective and considering it and asking on it, and each one having to then support their own thinking and see where it's wrong, where it's right, and argue it out, that's how you come to the truth. The Abarbanel also points out that the Gemara says that it's not good to learn from many different people. It's good to learn from one Rav. He says that even though it says Ezeo Chacham Halo made me call other, somebody learns from everybody. So some say you can learn from everybody, but you can only have one Rav. You only make one person your Rav. You can learn many things from a lot of people. They're not your Rav. But he says a little bit different. He says you can learn different regimens from different people. So not everybody is an expert in every area. So you can go to this one to learn this expertise and this one to learn this expertise. But in each regiment, you should only learn from one person. You shouldn't learn from many people. First, you learn the mathematics. Don't learn from many teachers. Learn from one teacher. If you're learning art, learn that from one teacher. But you can learn art and mathematics from two different teachers. Each one has his expertise. He brings down from the philosophers that a person who doesn't have a friend is like the right without the left. You're a half a person. In order for a person to really see this world properly, he needs friends who are mashlim him, who like the right and the left. If you have only the right or only the left, it's a distorted world. You need both sides. You always need something to compensate and to balance out each side. And that's another aspect of a friend. And then he says the last part of the Mishnah. We still haven't finished the Perush of the Abarbanel. The Hevidonis Kola Adam Lekatzchus. Judge all people favorably. And here the Abarbanel says a very interesting thing. He says that even though a person has to acquire a Rav and acquire a friend, the natural tendency is that if I have my Rav and my friend, then everybody else no good. It's my, everybody else, but having done his kolav, even the people not your Rav and not your friend, judge them favorably. Right, you may be this chassid or this yeshiva or whatever. Don't be mavakel everybody else. Don't look down on other people. Judge everybody favorably. Right, not only your right. Everybody has to be like you. Except the fact there could be other ways too. This is what's good for you. This is your rebbe. This is your rav. But there could be other rabbanim too. Right, somebody once came to the Chafetz Chaim and asked him, wouldn't it be better if all Jews were the same? Had the same minhagim, they dressed the same, they spoke the same, and not like we have, Ashkenazim, Sfardim, and Hasidim, and Misnagdim, and within each group, there's so many subgroups. Comes too complicated. Everyone the same way. It didn't say in the story which way he was referring to, but I'll tell you which way, his way. Everybody should be like me. Chofetz Chaim said, why don't you go and ask the Tsar this question? Right? Wouldn't it be more streamlined if he had one kind of army instead of all these different regiments and divisions? There's the army, the navy, the air force, cavalry, infantry. Just have one, everybody the same uniform, same function, and it's much cheaper, much more streamlined. You know what the Tsar will tell you? Yeah, it's much more streamlined, much cheaper, and much simpler. But I'll never win a war. In order to win a war, I got to cover all bases. So too, we are considered God's army. And in order to be effective, we have to cover a lot of bases. So not everybody can be the same. But everybody has to have allegiance to their division and their commanding officer, but they can also respect somebody in the army, can respect that there's a navy. It's not for me. I'm on the land. I get seasick. I can't be in the sea. But there are people that we need to be in the sea. They have to do their part. And I respect their leaders and respect because we're all in the same army. The person does that, then can exist. But if everybody thinks that their way is the only way, and you don't need other people, right? Everything becomes oversimplified, black and white, right? Everybody has to dress like me, and if anybody is different, then they're no good, then there's tremendous dissension and machlokas in Klal Yisrael. That's not the way things should be. So therefore, the Abarbanel says, even though Aseluch HaRav, everybody has to have their Rav, and everybody has to have their friends, but don't look down on other people's rav, or don't look down on other people's friends. It's possible there can be different paths. Chofetz Chaim says that in the end of Tainus, and I always say that if we kept this, it would be the end of a Tainus. Others quote this from Rabbi Kiva Eger already, or Shlomo Eger, before the Chofetz Chaim. But I saw it. And the Chofetz Chaim also saw it, that Reb Shlomo Eger says a similar thing. It says that in the future, God's going to make a big circle for the tzaddikim, and he's going to sit in the middle, and they're all going to point to the middle. This is the God we waited for. The Chofetz Chaim explains what it means is the following. In this world, there are many different kinds of tzaddikim. the tzaddikim who emphasize learning Torah, and amongst them different ways of emphasizing learning Torah, different paths, different drachim. And then there are tzaddikim who emphasize davening, and there's all different kinds of davening. And there are tzaddikim who emphasize gemilus chasadim, and there's all kinds of gemilus chasadim. Some people deal with poor people, some people with sick people, some people with orphans, widows, whatever. And they all think that their way is the bullseye, and everybody else is somewhere out in left field. So, in the future, God's going to put them all on a big circle, and he's going to sit in the middle. And you can have a tzaddik over here and a tzaddik 180 degrees on the other side. Completely different paths. But since God's in the middle, all the paths to the middle are equal. All the radii of the circle are equal. With one stipulation, that you're on the circle. If you're not on the circle, this doesn't apply. There are people who are off the circle. But if you're on the circle, meaning you have both legs on the circle, you believe in the Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh, and you have a Masorah, then you're on the circle. Doesn't make a difference where on the circle you are. You're equidistant from the center. Rav Simcha Wasserman Zatzal once said this over in Or Sameach. And one of the fresh Balei Tshuva raised his hand and he said, Rabbi, does that mean that the conservative and reform also have a place on the circle? So he said the idea with the army, right? That the Melech kind of divisions, Simcha's thought for a second, he said, yeah. He says, every army has its deserters also. So there are deserters also that they're not necessarily still in the army, but they're also part of the picture, just not from this side of the circle. They're on the other side of the circle. In any case, so unfortunately, we live in a world where people don't understand that, and they feel secure only with their Rebbe and their exact thing. There's people who dress exactly the same way as them, and they feel threatened by other people. Because if you really appreciate who you are, time yet, let me finish this idea up, and this will finish up what the Abarbanel says, I think. The Kutzker Rebbe said the following. He says, Imani ani, mipnei shani ani, v'ata ata, mipnei shata ata, az ani ani v'ata ata. Aval imani ani, mipnei shata ata, v'ata ata, mipnei shani ani, az ein ani ani, v'ein ata ata. What does it mean? If I know who I am and you know who you are, then we have identities. I'm me and you're you. But if I only know that I'm not you, I don't know who I am, but I know I'm not you, and you only know you're not me, then we neither of us have identities. A negative identity is not an identity. And then the Kutzker Rebbe also said the following. Binyan na'arim stira, ustira zakenim binyan. Fools, immature people, build themselves up by knocking other people down. And mature people knock other people down by building themselves up. Putting those two things together, Rabbi Twersky, in one of his books, says the following story, Marshall. There was a person who felt so insecure that he didn't know who he was except by his clothing. That's how he recognized himself. He was afraid to go into the mikveh because he'd forget who he was. So came Erev Yom Kippur, he had to go to the mikveh. So he tied a red string around his finger, thinking that he'll go into the mikveh with this red string tied loosely around his finger. Remember who he is? Went into the mikveh, the red string came off his finger and got tied around somebody else's finger. They both come out of the mikveh, the guy's staring at the other guy's finger, and he says, look, I know who you are, who am I? We've come to a situation where we recognize ourselves only by who we're not, and that's how we educate our children. We're not them, we're not them, we don't do this. What do we do? Who are we? That's a different story. But who we're not, that everybody has a negative identity. And therefore, we feel very insecure. We don't really know who we are, what our sheet is, that we can be proud of it. We just know who we're not. And we most of the time, therefore, recognize ourselves only by externals, not by the things that really make a difference. What kind of yarmulke you wear and what kind of socks you have on or whatever. Right? When I first came to Eretz Yisrael, Somebody told me that if you wear a black yarmulke in Eretz Yisrael, it's not like Chutz Laretz. If you wear a black yarmulke, you are anti-social, anti-Israel, and whatever. I said, everybody wears a black yarmulke? It's just putting on the yarmulke makes you like that? Yeah, that's it. So this was before virtual reality. It was like beyond my comprehension. Just put on a yarmulke and it like changes your whole outlook on life. And then somebody told one of my children in Cheder, he's about 11 years old at the time, 10 or 11, came home one day and he says, our Rebbe told us today that anybody who wears a knitted yarmulke can't be a Yirei Shamayim. It's impossible. Why? Because the Yirei Shamayim escapes through the holes. So I didn't want to contradict the Rebbe, but I didn't want my son to think that that was true. So I said to him, you know, Shlomi, I was in Meir Shorim last week, and all of the Toldos Aharon, Rabbi Arulis Hasidim, wear these big white knitted yarmulkes. Are you going to tell me there's not one of Rabbi Arulis Hasidim was a Yirei Shamayim because the Yirei Shamayim escaped? He said, well, maybe there's exceptions. I said, fine, let's leave it at that. Maybe it's not the yarmulke that gives you Yirei Shamayim or not. There's other criteria. You can't judge just by what kind of yarmulke a person, not black or, right? But that's how we are. We don't know who we are. We're not proud of what we are. We just know who we're not. And anybody who doesn't look exactly like us, we're mavato. So in that kind of world, you can't get along unless you don't judge anybody favorably except the people who look exactly like you. So that's what the Abar Benel says. Even though everybody has to have their own Rav and their own Chaverim, because everybody's different and everybody needs to have their division. But you don't look down on the other divisions. As long as we're on the circle, they all serve a purpose, and judge everybody favorably. So that's the Abar Benel. And even though he says judge everybody favorably, that's not really true. Next week we'll discuss who you're supposed to judge favorably and how you're supposed to judge people favorably. And does that mean you're supposed to live in a fantasy land and not see things properly? And if you're judging everybody favorably, how could you ever give people mussar and give them rebuke if you're judging them favorably and assuming that they're not doing anything wrong? So everybody's fine, you're okay, I'm okay, and people end up doing terrible things and never being told about it because everybody's judging everybody favorably. We'll see what the limitations are, so that is not the case.